At one point, the war planner spoke up to urge that the military fly in the 2nd ACR now, at least one squadron, and the whole regiment if you can. The point he remembered making to Rumsfeld was that the invasion force needed to do a better job of protecting its lines of communication, and that the regiment would be ideal for operating independently, securing key intersections, and reconnoitering routes. Even with the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment in the pipeline, senior military officials in both Washington and on the ground in Iraq worried as Baghdad was about to fall that the force lacked combat depth. Wolfowitz remained strongly opposed to sending the 2 heavy divisions, the 1st Armored and the 1st Cavalry. After one meeting, the senior officers involved in the discussion trudged downstairs to the offices of the Joint Staff. Casey, who at that point had been promoted to the important job of director of the Joint Staff, looked at his 2 key subordinates and said, "I think we just lost the 1st Cav." Casey indicated that he thought the running argument was eroding relations with Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, and so needed to be brought to an end, another Joint Staff officer recalled. Top officers feared that if the discussions dragged on, Rumsfeld would decide that the 1st Armored Division really wasn't needed either. So they made the argument to Rumsfeld that it was essential to send it, and to keep the 1st Cav on hold, possibly for sending in midsummer. The defense secretary ultimately agreed to that hedge plan, but there was an edge of bitterness to that session. As we were walking out the door of the office, the secretary's behind his desk and he looks up and says, "God damn it, I wonder how long it's going to take for this to get into the newspaper." In all these weeks of arguments over troop deployments, the voice that he thought was missing was that of General Franks. The military could have gotten it if the combatant commander had come down on it firmly and said, "I want the whole force package." Another disquieting note was that as the U.S. military invaded Iraq, U.S. intelligence picked up indications that Ahmed Chalabi's organization was conveying information about U.S. troop movements to the government of Iran. I don't want to say what the source was, but there was some evidence that there was an operational relationship between Chalabi and Tehran, said a senior U.S. military intelligence officer. It was during the first 10 days of the war, about the same time that we saw solid evidence that Iran had a plan, operators in the south, people moving back and forth. The difference between Tommy Franks and Tehran, he said grimly, was that the Iranians had a good Phase 4 plan. Asked much later about his relations with the Iranian government, Chalabi said, not completely clearly, "I did not pass any information to Iran that compromised any national security information of the United States." Despite these tremors, Chalabi still looked like the Pentagon's choice to lead post-war Iraq. In early April, the U.S. Air Force flew a few hundred members of Chalabi's militia to southern Iraq. The vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Marine General Peter Pace, envisioned a major role for them. "These are Iraqi citizens who want to fight for a free Iraq, who are, who will become, basically, the core of the new Iraqi army once Iraq is free," said Pace, the nation's number 2 military officer. "They are the beginning of the free Iraqi army." A statement issued by the Iraqi National Congress, INC, in Chalabi's name, said that the number of fighters is expected to increase quickly. As it happened, the force actually proved ineffective and did little. The official history produced by the Army Special Operations Command blamed its stall out partly on internal divisions in the U.S. government. The U.S. Defense Department championed Chalabi and the FIF, Free Iraqi Fighters, and saw them as a transitional force to be used in lieu of the police, it reported. The State Department, on the other hand, saw the FIF as nothing more than the military arm of the INC. That assessment, while accurate, is incomplete. Another more important division, one within the military establishment, actually crippled this force. Pentagon civilians, most notably Wolfowitz and Feith, supported the training of Iraqi forces, while Central Command dragged its feet. Chalabi later maintained that Abizaid, then one of Frank's 2 deputies, had told him not to fly to southern Iraq. "I did it anyway, and he was very angry," he said. It isn't clear why Rumsfeld and his subordinates were unable to make Central Command more responsive to civilian control. In principle, the training of Iraqis was exactly the right course, and ultimately the one that the U.S. military would settle on as the exit strategy for Iraq. But in the spring of 2003, the U.S. military wasn't yet interested. Retired Marine Lieutenant General Michael DeLong, Franks's other deputy, called the training effort a waste of time and energy for us. He reported of Chalabi's militia, while some of them were helpful in small battles, we received many more reports of their looting and thievery in Baghdad.